Warnings, especially anyone who's listening to this particular tape and who's not been here. One of my fears, especially some of the material covered in other seminars, will be heard or listened to by people who have not been to either the IBC seminar, basic seminar, or to this particular seminar. And one of the difficulties with that, and so that's why I'm spending a moment, is that if you're planning on listening and you've not been to the basic IBC seminar, which I know doesn't count you, or if you've not been to what you're now at, then my strongest recommendation is to turn the tape off and watch Family Ties. Because the material that I'll be covering really does assume that you've done certain things. One, that you've been here this whole week. It does assume at least minimally that you've been to the IBC seminar, basic seminar, and also to a large degree that you've read The Marriage Builder. I would not think, but I'm sure it's possible, that many of you have not read, but I'm going to assume that you've read The Marriage Builder, that you've been to the basic seminar, you've heard the concepts there, so I can use the lingo again, you've heard our section on marriage in the basic seminar, and that you've read or that you've been here and had interactions with us and observed the tapes with Mike and Janine. So with all that, what I'm going to suggest is I'll cover some very important material very, very briefly, because I don't see any need to take time to spend on what you can read or what you've already covered through. So that's why I say an overview of God's ideal, that's oneness. That's all I need to say now. I can move on to the second topic. I want to spend just a few minutes on that. God's goal is oneness. God's goal in unity of relationship with His people and in relationship of His people with His people is unity, oneness. And that shows up primarily, essentially, in relationship of the husband and the wife. Let me make some comments about spirit oneness. All I'm suggesting with spirit oneness is we're talking about the power source of the individual to be able to give him or herself to the other freely and joyfully. If there's not a core relationship with the Lord, there won't be the power source to be able to give to the other person. You cannot be a servant unless you've been served. You cannot be a servant unless you've been served. And the Lord served us by His death and resurrection. And so He served us and enables us, because we now have been loved, to love. And therefore, without spirit oneness, in other words, ultimately a core relationship with the Lord, there will be no good relationship the way God intended. The relationship with a spouse ultimately can be no better than relationship with the Lord. The relationship with one spouse can ultimately be no better than relationship with the Lord, unless the couple engages and uses major denial in order to keep pleasantries and warmth going, but without real substance in terms of relationship with the Lord. The source of strength to fulfill the task of giving oneself to one spouse can be accomplished only if what the Lord gives you is exceedingly abundant. You will only be able to give yourself freely to your spouse if what you've been given by the Lord is something exceedingly abundant. Otherwise, the cost of what's involved in loving your spouse will be too great, and therefore you'll settle for superficiality. If what you have been given by the Lord is something gripping, it's the only basis for real love. Otherwise, the cost involved in really having a godly marriage is too great, and most people will not attempt to move into it. As it's been said before, I say it again, obviously the relationship with the Lord cannot be measured by externals. Too many people spend hours in the Scriptures. Too many people have calluses on their knees from being strong prayer warriors. And I wouldn't give you a nickel for their spirituality, because in many respects, they're people who do not know how to groan. They're people who do not know how to be in anguish. They don't know how to struggle. They don't know the battle against sin. At core, they're externalists. So you cannot measure relationship with the Lord or spirit oneness on the basis of obvious externals. Not that those externals, again, we keep fencing ourselves, but I want to say it again. Not that those externals won't be there. Of course they'll be there. But you simply cannot measure on externals. You measure on what? A couple quick categories. How does the person deal with conflict? How open are they to feedback? And how gripped are they by the feedback that helps them see that they're not all that they could be in the Lord? If you want one primary category, from my perspective, that is the most important category, is the person open to feedback. More will be told in that than practically any other spiritual category I know. Because the person not open to feedback on some level is depending more on their own independence than on relationship with the Lord. It's harder to fake openness than it is prayer or Bible reading or many other spiritual exercises. How do they handle criticism? How do they handle pain? How do they handle disappointment? How do they handle confusion? All those are key questions to discerning what one's spirit source is. Is one in spirit relationship, spirit oneness with the Lord? Those categories I just quickly went through, I think, are crucial. Now again, I know I'm covering a lot of material quickly. I'll tell you my philosophy would be, if you've come, I'd almost ask you, don't bother taking notes. Get the tape. Spend another, whatever it is, $7. Don't try and take too many notes. Allow the material just to float through your minds rather than trying to copiously get your notes down. If it's important enough to you to have taken notes, then it'll probably be important enough to you to buy the tape. And if it's not worth buying the tape, let me tell you, it's not worth taking notes for. Soul oneness. Let me just make a few quick comments about soul oneness. All I'm talking about soul oneness is real capacity to have relational involvement. What I'm suggesting, and I'd only, because of time, only encourage you to look at the passage later. John 15, verses 9 through 17. Basically, let me summarize it very quickly. The passage there is saying, if you love me, the Lord says, you will do what? You will keep my commandments. You will obey me. And then he goes on to say in that passage, this is my commandment. If you obey me, you love me. If you love me, you obey me. And then he strikingly says, this is my commandment. What's his commandment? That you love one another. And then he gives a picture of what loving one another is. No greater love than for what? For a person to lay down his life for another. And the very last verse of that particular passage is, this is my commandment. He says it all over again. This is my commandment. Love one another. The place where godliness is first and foremost evidenced in its richest form is in the way you love one another. And therefore, how you interact with another person, that which we call soul oneness, is where the evidence of spirit oneness is first, foremost, highest epitome seen and experienced. Spirit oneness is worked out in soul oneness, in the way we communicate. And again, I don't mean communicational styles. I'm not going to get into that. All I want to say is the capacity to relate to another human being in a way that touches them. That's what we're talking about with soul oneness. The capacity to touch another human being with words, primarily with words. Of course, it can be physical touch included, of course. Nonverbal, verbal communication. Again, it goes just simply back to the passage in Ephesians 4:29. Let no unwholesome word pass from your mouth, but only words that are good for edification according to the need of the moment. That our words are to have great impact, soul oneness. We're talking about the way you relate in the context of love. And therefore, what we're talking about is not, when we talk about soul oneness, we're not talking about the issue of stability. Stability is, in most cases, the enemy of growth. Stability, in most cases, is the enemy of growth. Growth occurs through conflict. It doesn't occur through comfortability. And therefore, where I see a stable marriage, I think in most cases, not all, but in most cases, you have a superficial marriage. So stability is no sign of godliness. Often, it's a sign of high denial. I'm more concerned with how the couple deals with issues of their longings and their wrong strategies. My wife has to have a basic core commitment if she's going to love me. And that is to arouse my longings and help me see my wrong strategies. What anyone in the world who's willing to stick their neck into my buzzsaw in order to help me see my wrong strategies is in for a fight. I'm not a godly man in the sense that I'm willing to automatically hear your feedback and do something with it. I think there's a core integrity within me that I'm willing to deal with what you give me, but it isn't going to be easy. And you better have enough strength to stick out a good fight with me if you love me enough to help me grow. And therefore, if my wife's committed to stability, in no way can she be committed to my growth in the Lord. And therefore, stability is something that in most cases is destructive. She must be committed to arousing my longings and helping me see my wrong strategies. And so communication is really the issue of how well we deal with touching what we were made for and removing the blocks that keep us from enjoying the fruits of relationship. So communication is really how well are we able to stick it out together to be able to deal with one another as we really help one another, Colossians 1:28, each other. I want for my wife, and why I've been given to my wife is ultimately to help her be mature in Christ. There's no higher call, there's no higher love that I can do or give to any other human being than to help them grow in Christ. So ultimately, I'm not there for my wife's happiness. I'm not there to make her a happy woman. Much of my love for her has made her very unhappy. But ultimately, joyful. Because maturity in Christ brings joy. That's soul oneness. Let me move into body oneness. Physical expression of oneness. Spirit oneness will lead to the expression of love in the way we communicate. And from soul oneness will arise physical oneness, which brings pleasure. Passages, again, I would love for you to look at in a little bit more detail later. Proverbs 5, 15 through 19. Powerful passage. I may look at that one real briefly with you. Look at Proverbs chapter 5. Again, it's a chance for me to use a portion of my education that costs so much. Proverbs chapter 5, verse 15 through 19. It says, drink from the waters. Drink water from your own cistern. Running water from your own well. Should your springs overflow in the streets and your streams of water in public squares, let them be yours alone, never to be shared with strangers. May your fountain be blessed, and may you rejoice in the wife of your youth. A loving doe, a graceful deer, may her breast satisfy you always. May you ever be captivated by her love. Verse 19. A loving doe, a graceful deer, may her breasts satisfy you. The word there in Hebrew is the word that means to be full of water, as a sponge would be if it were absolutely satiated. It's an expression of such fullness, such satiation, such absolute molecular fullness that the sponge could not take one dripping molecule into its being. Second word there in verse 19, may you be ever captivated by her love. There are three basic words in Hebrew for drunkenness. First word means, oh, you're a little higher than you should be if you weren't drinking. Second word means you're drunk and it's very clear you ought not drive. The third word means you're so drunk that you couldn't even crawl. The word that's used, captivated, there, is the word that means so drunk you can't walk. So drunk you can't crawl. It's the image of being so not only satiated, but so satisfied that you're absolutely, in a sense, exhausted by love. The scriptures are powerful in their expression of sexuality. Song of Solomon's, just to offend you. If you'll go to Song of Solomon, chapter 4, the description of the lover, some of it's kind of bizarre, but nevertheless interesting. I'm afraid if I tried to tell this to my wife, I might end up on the couch for some time. But it says, "How beautiful are you, my darling? Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes behind your veil are doves. Your hair is like a flock of goats descending from Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep just shorn, coming up from the washing. Each has its twin. Not one of them is alone. Your lips are like the scarlet ribbon. Your mouth is lovely." And what I want you to notice is, where does the description begin? It begins up here. I want you to notice the progression. "Your temples behind your veil are like halves of a pomegranate. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with elegance. On it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. Your two breasts are like two fawns, like twin fawns of a gazelle that browse among the lilies. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee, I will go to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of incense. All beautiful are you, my darling. There is no flaw in you." What's the description? What's the mountain of myrrh? That's the pubic area of a woman. It's very clearly in Near Eastern ancient literature, the imagery being used is he's taking apart her body. It's very clear he's going from the top down to the core sexual area and saying, it's all lovely. It's very clear, though it's offensive to many to hear this, that the Song of Solomon talks very clearly, if you understand the imagery, especially in terms of the near ancient culture, talks very graphically and very clearly about the enjoyment of oral sex. The incense, the smell of fragrance, all was meant to be the joy and delight in terms of the smell of the pubic area. The scriptures are as blunt and graphic as practically any pornographic magazine can be, but of course, in the context of what? Spirit oneness, soul oneness, physical oneness. Look at Ezekiel chapter 16. Ezekiel chapter 16, verses 7 through 9. Description of the relationship between the Lord and his people. Ezekiel 16, verses 7 through 9. "I made you grow like a plant of the field. You grew up and developed and became the most beautiful of jewels. Your breasts were formed and your hair grew. You were naked and bare. Later, I passed by, and when I looked at you and saw that you were old enough for love, I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your nakedness. I gave you my solemn oath and entered into a covenant with you, declares the sovereign Lord, and you became mine. I bathed you with water and washed the blood from you and put ointments on you." Well, goodness, what's that a description of? Let's not be bashful. It's a description of lovemaking. It's a description when in the ancient day, a man was describing his wedding day. It was he would cover his wife's nakedness. He would put his, if you will, his blanket over her and then move into sexual relations with her. And because she was a virgin, then he would clean her up. The blood that would have come from splitting of the hymen would have then been washed up tenderly by the lover. See, the scriptures want to make clear to us what the relationship between the Lord and his people are like. And one of the most significant images in the scriptures that try and typify, try and give some expression of what our relationship with the Lord is to be like, is the marriage feast of the Lamb. In other words, the sexual relationship between the Father, the Son, the Spirit, God himself, and his people. He enters us. He comes into us. The imagery is clear here. So sad that few Christian marriages know the joy sexually that's available for couples who really know what spirit and soul oneness is about. What's my point through going all through this? Body oneness, sexual oneness, is to mirror the pleasure and the presence of God's Spirit. It's a foretaste. Orgasm is a foretaste of what heaven's going to be. It's an intense, consuming, pleasurable awareness that comes in a matter of a few seconds, but gives a very singular taste of what eternity will be, because it will be as relationship with the Lord. God's ideal is for sexual joy to be available for every married couple. And where that sexual joy isn't satiating and creating drunkenness, something's being missed. Something is being missed. Let's not pretend that any of us have come anywhere near close to that joy, any more than we've come close to the joy of richly knowing that our God is our God. Every part of life needs to be worked on, and that one in particular needs work for almost all couples. But let's not forget the design, the purpose, and the calling of real sexual pleasure. We as believers should be the ones who are making known to the world their sex pleasure beyond comprehension in relationship with one spouse, built on the relationship with the Lord. Relationship with the Lord ought to free us to be able to enter into not only physical oneness, communicational oneness, and spiritual oneness in ways that are just simply unimaginable to anyone who has not tasted of the Lord in that particular way. That's what the Lord's intending for oneness. What are the obstacles? What are the obstacles to oneness? I want to talk very, very briefly about what I want to call male, typical male patterns and typical female patterns. Typical male, typical female patterns. Again, I want to warn you that I want to use shorthand. I want to remind you of the material that was covered in the IBC course on maleness and femaleness, not only the material that was covered in terms of marriage. So if you're going to recall much of what I'm going to say, or put it into perspective much of what I'm going to say, you really do need to review your notes that you took on maleness and femaleness from the IBC basic course and on your marriage notes, because I want to cover some material without defending my position. I don't want to have to take time to defend it scripturally or biblically. I'm going to assume that you have had some basic thinking about that, and that our arguments at least were in simple, elementary form laid out prior to this particular seminar. I want to get to other material. General patterns, general typical patterns. The key to understanding all variations of patterns with men can be summarized in one or two words. It's an avoidance of leadership. All basic patterns that a male will exhibit revolve around the issue of avoidance of leadership. In other words, I define servanthood or leadership along the same lines. For a man to be a leader means that he's the first to suffer. What it means to be a man and to be a husband, to be a leader, means he's the first to suffer. He's the first to die to self. He's the first to ask, how might I be last in my relationship with my spouse? What it means to be a man, what it means to be a husband in this sense, means he's willing to accept the reality of the curse. What's the man's curse? That he will toil by the sweat of his brow against what? Thorns and thistles. Now, is that just the fact that weeds grew up outside and now we've got to pull them? Or is that in some sense a symbol of all of what we've got to deal with in life? The encroachment of decay is constantly upon us. The encroachment of weeds are constantly upon us. And therefore, as a man, I must be willing to go out and pull the weed up. I must be the first one to have my hand pricked by the weeds. My wife must see me as, in Ephesians 5, the one who's willing to mirror what Christ did for the church. And what did Christ do for the church? He died and washed her in water and blood. And therefore, I must be the one who first and foremost is willing to die for my spouse. But generally speaking, the effect of the curse, the effect of the fall is better said, a man, is that he chooses to avoid being a leader, i.e. being a servant. Fundamentally, he avoids being a servant. He handles the anguish of thorns and thistles by one key word. Avoidance. Let me give you some nearly invariant aspects. Nearly invariant aspects of that pattern. In other words, most men are going to exhibit some of these aspects of that commitment of avoidance. First of all, there will be an avoidance of responsibility primarily through blame shifting. Since the fall, Adam showed us first how to do it, and we've learned quite well. We always put the blame on someone else for something that is ours first to take. The assumption seems to be for most men, I would handle my world well only if, and then you fill the blank. I could handle my world well if I'd had a good father, if I only had more money, if somehow my life were different, then my life would be different. But it's not me that's responsible to be different. That assumption seems to be very built into the male psyche. Second aspect, or second almost near invariant aspect, is that there will be distance in relationship to the degree that there's possibility of being exposed as inadequate. I will distance myself from the person or situation that most likely will expose me as inadequate. Third, almost invariant aspect, is that I will pursue whatever provides me with a strong sense of adequacy. And in most cases, the last thing that provides me with a sense of adequacy is relationships. And so very rarely will a man naturally pursue relationships. Because more than any place in the world or the universe to experience an adequacy is in the context of relationship. And therefore a man will almost invariably move outside a relationship, or another way of saying that now, outside the home to find satisfaction of his longings. Let me give you some flexible patterns now. These are not typical in the sense They are typical, but they're not common to all men. The ones I've just covered, I think, are very common to all men. They're near invariant. These are variant. There is variance here. There are four I want to talk about very, very briefly. Then I want to move to the woman, and then I'll try and tie the two patterns, or the male-female patterns together. Four basic patterns that I want to talk about. Let me warn you, I'm reducing what's there in terms of reality. There's no way in the world you can talk about four major patterns that men exhibit. There are as many patterns as there are men. So I can't be more reductionistic in the world to somehow reduce perhaps 100,000 categories down to four. I think I'm leaving out a lot. Now, I think I'm also including a lot by giving you four, but please don't simplistically reduce what I give you, even though I shall. Four patterns. One, the little boy pattern. The little boy pattern. And again, some of these patterns, by very naming them, I hope to be very clear so I don't have to spend time defining it very far. The little boy pattern. Take care of me. I'm a little kid who cannot handle his world. Somehow you must come through for me. I'm not strong enough. I'm not big enough. I'm not potent enough to make any impact in my world. I need my mommy to take my hand and lead me. That's the little boy pattern. Second pattern, we'll call the nice guy pattern. I'm a swell human being. I'm a nice human being. I'm there for you. I care for you. I'll be kind to you. I'm really a pleasant, warm, engaging human being. But my number one commitment is to avoid any possibility of conflict. I'll do much for you, but enter into anything that might involve conflict. Third pattern is what I want to call the out-of-state husband. The out-of-state husband. The husband who simply is distantly involved. He just isn't around. He works 8 to 12 to 15 to 16 hours a day. And when he is home, he reads the paper, he watches TV, he simply engages in anything other than involvement. You know, the nice guy is a nice guy. He's a mean guy. He's a jerk. He's an angry, arrogant, bossy, pushy man. Those are four patterns. We can put them on a continuum, and I'll be putting this up in a second, from what I want to call passive avoidance. Now, watch me draw my imaginary line. Passive avoidance, what's right here? Near passive avoidance. The little boy. Close to the little boy, but not all the way over to what I want to call aggressive avoidance. What's next, according to the little boy? The nice guy. But as we move further to the aggressive avoider, what do we have next? The out-of-state husband. And then finally, the hostile, arrogant twit. All right, so we have a line, a continuum. The continuum is the continuum of avoidance. It's not that the aggressive man is any less of an avoider. It's just a different style of avoidance. Aggressive avoidance versus the little boy who's passive avoidance. Let me talk about the woman now. Typical female patterns. The key to understanding all variations of patterns with a woman are the words, the attempt to take control. The attempt to take control as a means of avoiding relational pain and emptiness. All surrounding the issue of an attempt to control as a means of avoiding relational pain and emptiness. Let me give you some what I want to call nearly invariant patterns, nearly variant components of that. First of all, there's almost always an attempt to control by taking relational responsibility. Almost always, in almost all women, you'll find an attempt to be relationally responsible. I'm the one who will make this relationship work. I will make this relationship work. Second aspect is usually, if not almost always, an attempt to fill relational emptiness by direct manipulation of those who they are in relationship with. There's always an attempt to fill relational pain or emptiness by the manipulation of those who they're in relationship with. And usually it takes two forms, either protection or correction. And almost always, in most women, very, very few have I ever worked with who didn't have an enormous sense of weighted responsibility that eventuated in an enormous sense of pressure. Women are by far the burden bearers of relationships. They're the pack mules of relationships. And therefore, often, almost invariably, you'll have these words associated with the female pattern of control, and that is a sense of responsibility, a sense of protection of their weak, poor, enabled, impotent husbands. So, in some sense, responsible, some sense, a protectorate, in some sense, a corrector or umpire, and also experiencing enormous pressure. Those are some of what I want to call invariant patterns, invariant aspects. But you notice I put the word nearly invariant. Let me talk about some of the flexible variations. Some of the flexible variations. First of all, I will call the little girl or the helpless little girl pattern. This woman's naive, often silly, in its so-called hysterical components, often seductive. A person who simply is not going to make it unless a strong man takes hold and leads and directs. Second pattern. I want to call, and I don't have good words for this. If you have better words at some point, you let me know. So let me ramble with it. I want to call it the gracious hostess. The warm, people-pleasing doormat. The gracious hostess, who's more than just a gracious hostess, she's just a very warm, pleasing people-pleaser. She's a doormat. Maybe the best word for that is simply the word doormat. Third pattern, and again, my terms are just my terms. You make up whatever terms you like. Third pattern is what I would call the busy bee. The woman who's just actively engaged almost continually. She could be an executive working in a large corporation, handling her family, handling her corporate duties, maybe involved in Kiwanis, involved in the PTO, involved in, that's what we call it, PTO, involved in all sorts of things. She's simply on the move all the time. Generally speaking, she's a very confident, a very in control, overtly in control person. The busy bee. Something about her, she's somewhat relationally distant. She can be extremely dutiful, but distant, or maybe and distant. Final category, fourth category, is what I want to call the liberationist. She's angry, she's vehement, she's distancing. She's castrating. She looks for opportunities to put people down, but more particularly, just a real strong desire to make a man suffer. All right, so you have what I want to call a continuum with that. And now let me use the y-axis. At the very top, what are we talking about? We're talking about the category of control. And so what at the very top we have, helpless control, which moves down the line to what I want to call emasculating control. Helpless control down to emasculating control. And what's obvious? What's at the very top in terms of helpless control? Obviously the little girl. And then a little lower down would be the gracious hostess doormat. And then on the other side would be, on the way toward the emasculating controller, would be the busy bee, and then finally, of course, the liberationists. Let me put all this on the board for you now, so you have the two categories. Can you see in the back? My eyes are bad enough, I just can't tell if they're focused. Is it focused? Okay, thank you. All right, obviously, that's what we just went through. If you'll notice, in the circle is where I believe the ideal is. The ideal for the man is to be strong and involved. Strong, involved, a servant who knows how to move with clear directionality. He has courage. He's a man of integrity. And yet he's deeply involved and very, very susceptible to feeling and experiencing the impact of his wife or others. That's the ideal for the man. The ideal for the woman, that she be a woman who's vulnerable and involved, who's open, capable of being honest and strong, speaking truth in love, but neither an umpire nor one who stirs up. That's the ideal. Now, let me briefly talk about the interaction of the patterns. You can see I have four quadrants, correct? Four basic quadrants. Quadrant one, quadrant two, quadrant three, quadrant four. First of all, let me just say, in terms of most of the people that will come for counseling, will come either for one of two reasons. Either they're distant and superficial, and some major event has rocked their marriage to the point of collapse. Very seldom will you have a distant, superficial couple come into your office or come to work with you unless some major event has kind of smacked them in the face. And what major event might it be? It could be a child who's run away. They're not coming for marriage counseling. They're coming because their child ran away. But what they need in order to be effective in terms of dealing with their child is marriage counseling. But that's not what they've come for. What other event? Could be a death. Could be major financial calamity. In other words, many, many people come to your work. Let me keep using the word office. Come to your office, but they're not coming for marriage counseling. But in fact, their marriage is the central issue. Be very aware, in marriage, the quality of the relationship between husband and wife affects literally every part of that individual's life. Their business, their use of money, their use of time, etc., etc. Marriage relationship is the foundation for everything. And therefore, a lot of couples will come who are distanced and superficial, but not aware of that, and are coming for other reasons. Perhaps in our day and age, one of the most prominent reasons for couples who are distant and superficial to come for marriage counseling is because of an affair. In a distant, superficial relationship, there's usually at least one hungry partner that wants something that can often be easily and quickly and illegitimately found in an affair. A lot of times, couples will come because of the affair. Second reason that people come is because they've gotten themselves to a point of absolute hostile debauchery. They're simply about to kill themselves or kill one another. They're at a point where, for whatever reason, they're open enough to face the fact that their marriage is pathetic. Those are the two major factors for people coming for marriage counseling. Now, let me talk about the interaction of patterns. Who are you likely to see in your office? People from quadrant one? What do you think? Yay or nay? The answer is nay. Very, very few people will come. At its very worst, if you're following this, like a Y and X axis, you plot 2 points, go up from the little boy to its extreme and the little girl at its extreme. What you have here, and I don't want to spend time on it, I just want to use a term. If it makes sense to you, fine. If it doesn't, that's fine as well. What you have there are usually borderline personalities. And there are many individuals who marry another borderline personality. So you have a borderline marriage. Individuals who are so severely socially deficient, they have very, very few abilities to relate to any human being. Often you'll have an individual who's in this category of being a little boy who's also a narcissist. An individual who's so committed to his own well-being, he has almost no sense of conscience or empathy or concern for another human being. So in most cases where you have, up in this extreme left corner, quadrant one, you're not going to see many people for counseling in that particular category. Are you going to see people at the lower part of the quadrant? The nice guy, gracious, people-pleasing doormat? No, unless what? Unless an affair has occurred. Generally speaking, you're not going to get those people to be too hostile. They're not going to be hostily relating to one another, about to kill one another. They're just too nice. I mean, this is the good Christian stable marriage, superficial and distant, but it looks so good. And if they have the pleasant Christian veneer, trusting the Lord, going to church every Sunday, and smiling and talking about how good the Lord's been to me, well, I'll tell you, you'll be very easily convinced this is a godly marriage. Oh, yes, sirree, a godly marriage. All they're able to do is live so effectively on denial that they live so comfortably with their patterns of self-protection working dovetailed together. Look at the woodwork around here and notice how the dovetail is perfect. That's many marriages in this category. What about quadrant four? You're going to see many people in that? Go again, down to the extreme. The emasculating, controlling liberationists married to the hostile, arrogant twit. Let me be again blunt with you. It depends on their social class. If they're of a lower economic class, these are the people who go out drinking at night and come back and brawl and love it. On one level, it's simply a part of life. fighting with one another, beating over one another over the head, if you've never worked with a lower economic class individual who literally fight a Friday or Saturday night without beating one another up, is simply on one level. I'm not trying to be comical, but it's just not a good Saturday evening. So lower socioeconomic class, you'll find in this category individuals who are, frankly, killing one another, but they get along pretty well. What about higher socioeconomic class? If you've never read the novel, it's worth your reading. You won't like me if I say it, but I'm willing to say it. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Excellent book to talk about in higher socioeconomic classes. Individual who's a liberationist and an arrogant, aggressive twit. You basically have people who kill one another and yet get along. Are they likely to come for counseling? The answer is no. What about anywhere else in this category? What if you have somewhere about an out-of-state husband married to a busy bee? They're too busy. They're not with one another enough to know how unhappy they are. And so you simply are not going to have, in most cases, people from quadrant one and quadrant four to work with. Now, again, I've worked in counseling for about 8 to 10 years, and I probably have clients that, as I think back, probably about 15%, 10 to 15% in quadrant one and 10 to 15% in quadrant four. But the vast majority will be in quadrant two and quadrant three. Quadrant two, what's this like? Let me say quadrant two is the typical strongly Christian home, where you have basically a strong man who's distant and but in control, and a woman who buys into a view of submission which basically says, keep your mouth shut. That is the typical evangelical, strong religious home. Strong, somewhat arrogant, strong, somewhat dominant man who's going to do what he wants and is not highly affected by his wife, and a woman who largely keeps her mouth shut in relationship with him. That's the typical, what I want to call, strong evangelical home. What basically should be done? Again, I'm wanting to boil this down to its pure, simple statement. What do you want to do in that particular home? What you want to do with the man is to help him learn what it means to be a servant. And that means to hurt deeply by learning how to deeply die to himself and to put himself last by allowing his wife to have great impact on him. And with the wife, what are you wanting to do? Help her learn, again, in its most simple essence, to speak truth powerfully, strongly, pointedly, powerfully in love. In other words, you want the woman, simplistically put, to move down toward real strength, and the man to move toward what looks like real weakness. If I had to put Mike and Janine, I don't want to put the Mike and Janine on right now. Let me go back for a while. All right. Quadrant three. What I want to call that is the typical American home. Not the typical evangelical home, but the typical American home. The distant, uninvolved, weak father and the strong, competent, capable, controlling mother and wife. So you have, if you will, the typical Christian home, strong evangelical Christian home, fundamentalistic home, and you have the typical American home. What are you going to want to do here? What's your task, again, simply put, with the man? What are you going to want to do? I would put it as simply as this. What you're hoping to accomplish is to help him become courageous in directionality. Courageous in being able to move, to take hold. He needs to become, if you will, a leader who's not just suffering servant and willing to give up, but who gives up by taking hold and taking over. And with a woman, you want to bring her to deeper pain, because a woman in that quadrant is likely experienced in the past great pain, but is unwilling to experience pain today. So you must lead that person into deeper pain, which as a result will, if it's the kind of pain we've been talking about all week, is the kind of pain that will bring warmth, softness, and what I want to call relational desirability, huggability, Women that I've worked with who've been in this particular quadrant are not women that you feel attracted to as a man. You don't feel like hugging that person. You don't feel close to that person. And the desire is that they come to a point where, as you look at them, there's a sense of softness, a sense of desirability, relational desirability. That's the task in terms of quadrant two and in terms of quadrant three. Our tasks in most churches will be to work with those in two and three, quadrants two and quadrants three. All right, let me move now into talking about a philosophy of interaction. A philosophy of interaction. But let me make a few points beforehand. When you hear someone say, let's move into another topic, and then they say, let's make a few more points, it means they didn't look at their notes to see that they had a couple more points to make. Let me summarize this diagram by making just a few more points. When you deal with people on the ends of the quadrant, understand that you're just dealing with severe marriage problems. And the more severe the problem, the more likelihood of having to work in individual counseling. The more severe the problem, the more likelihood of having to work in individual counseling. When you have an individual, for example, who's a strong, strong, strong little boy married to, let's say, a gracious, people-pleasing doormat, so somewhere in this category right here, I think it's very likely that this individual, the little boy, is going to need individual work as well as marital work. It may mean that as well in terms of this person too, but less likely so. So when you start working toward the outer ends of the quadrant, know that the problem's more severe and will likely involve more individual work along with the marital work. Generally, second point, the person closest to the center is usually the person who's most open and most willing to work on the marriage. The individual who's closest to the center is, generally speaking, the person who's most open. Now, that, I'd love to say that's always true. It's just not. But as a rule of thumb, with more exceptions than the rule, generally speaking, I'll say the person closer to the center is more open and more easily worked with. Yes, ma'am. Very, very often, in most cases, I'd say 60%, 70% of my cases, I begin first with a woman because the man won't come in. And often, case, it is the woman who, at first glance, is most open. If you notice my language. Third point that I want to make in summary is that I want you to be aware of what I want to call the dovetailing of self-protective patterns. We generally speaking marry someone who fits us well. We generally speaking marry someone who fits us well. Some time ago I worked with an individual, and again it's so descriptive of so many people. He was a quiet and shy person, and he wanted someone, if you will, to draw him out. He wanted someone to kind of be the John the Baptist for him and open the way. She was an outgoing, gregarious, pleasant, warm, socially desirable person who John the Baptist for him. And that worked well for years. But the difficulty is with someone who's a John the Baptist, they tend to eat locusts and live in the wilderness, and they tend to be rather strongly odoriferous people. Do you get my point? She was a strong woman. Very strong woman. And that worked well for him because he wanted a strong woman. But what did it do at the core? In fact, does a man want a strong woman defined as one who's going to be the John the Baptist? The answer is no. So after a short period of time, he got tired of her controlling him, got tired of her taking charge. So the pattern that at first was attractive usually turns to be vile and disgusting. Generally speaking, that's the pattern in most marriages. The very things that first attracted you to your spouse often are the very things that you find most unattractive after a number of years of marriage. Patterns dovetail, in other words, they work. People don't get married because they hate one another. And yet they hate one another because the patterns that fit at first now violate the core desire inside to be a strong man and to be a vulnerable, loved woman.
How does that relate to second and third marriages?
Let me now talk about a philosophy of interaction. I'm just teaching this stuff. I don't know what I'm talking about. Yes. Second, third, fourth marriages often tend to repeat the same basic pattern. Even though they hate what they saw, generally speaking, they follow the same basic format, but with a slight shift. It's as if at times the person has lost, again using another category, lost formal operations, and they become concrete thinkers. They look at only one thing that's different. The man who I divorced before wasn't wealthy. This one is. But in almost every other respect, the carbon copies. But it's as if they've been able to localize on one particular difference and say, oh, lovely, I've got a different kind of man who then turns out to be very, very similar. So, immediately in my own mind, I process clients. As I talk, people flash through my mind. And, of course, right now I'm thinking of two or three individuals who are very different than that. So, again, I'm saying a pattern, but please don't be naive to think that any of us fit any patterns. Let me talk now about a philosophy of interaction, and then in just a few moments we'll take a break. What I want to start with before I break is this basic core point. I want to talk about a session-by-session philosophy of interaction. But please, as what I just said a moment ago, buy 100%. There's no such thing as an ideal structure. I've never had a session. I've never had marriage counseling go the way I'm talking about. What I did was, I sat down and said, if I had the ideal sinful couple, and I were the ideal sinful counselor, and I could work with this couple, and things happen the way that I would love to map it out, you know, Hollywood scripted, this is the way it is. All of us know there is no good ship, lollipop. Therefore, why bother talking about session by session? See, I don't know. I really don't know. But I do want you to have some scope. And I always hated English. I always hated learning English because for whatever rule you learn, there always seemed to be so many exceptions. Is it I after E after O? Or after C? Well, see, that's my point. Every individual is like a snowflake. They're just different, but they look the same. But, this is a really profound comparison, but there's a real difference between snow and hail.